So that's Psalm 11 on page 533. Hear the word of the Lord. To the choir master of David. In the Lord I take refuge. How can you say to my soul, flee like a bird to your mountain? For behold, the wicked bend the bow. They have fitted their arrow to the string, to shoot in the dark at the upright in heart. If the foundations are destroyed, what can the righteous do? The Lord is in his holy temple. The Lord's throne is in heaven. His eyes see, his eyelids test the children of man. The Lord tests the righteous, but his soul hates the wicked and the one who loves violence. Let him rain coals on the wicked. Fire and sulfur and a scorching wind shall be the portion of their cup. For the Lord is righteous. He loves righteous deeds. The upright shall behold his face. This is the word of the Lord, and you may be seated. Well, thank you so much, Pastor Joshua, and musicians for leading us so far. I'm dealing with some allergies or cold, and so if I sound a little stuffy, that's all it is. But we're so thankful for you guys serving us in that way. And in so many ways, whether you realize this or not, what you heard in the scripture reading from Mark and what you sung is a great preview of themes in Psalm chapter 11. So we'll say a bit more about that in just a moment. Also, this is the time of year that we recognize graduates. And I know we have some at our church and even some in our midst today. And so I won't embarrass you and make you walk up front or stand up. But if you are a graduate, just so we can give thanks to the Lord, would you just slip your hand in the air and let us see you there? There. I knew we had at least one. All right. Congratulations, Grace, and to all of our graduates, some who are not here today. We are just so thankful for the Lord's enabling grace to get you through your program of study. And that works on two levels, get you through your program of study and carry you on to what may be next. So congratulations. All right. During the last week in October, 1938, the cast and crew of Orson Welles' upcoming radio drama were not very high on its prospects. Quote, just between us, it's lousy, one actor told a radio critic. It'll, quote, probably bore you to death. Very dull, very dull, a technician told the 23-year-old Welles. It'll put him to sleep. Gentle listener, it did not put anyone to sleep. In fact, thanks to some late changes to the script, it sent some hearers into a panic, convinced that the very foundations of society were crumbling. The broadcast was an adaptation of the 1898 sci-fi novel called The War of the Worlds, and it featured fictional news reports of aliens landing at a farm in New Jersey, incinerating police and military with their heat rays, and killing civilians in droves with their poison smoke. In several places, the actors playing news correspondents are in the middle of their broadcast when the aliens dramatically kill them and the audio feed goes dead. Under orders from Welles to spice up the drama, the actors shriek in abject horror. The sound effect technicians create noises to simulate alien spacecraft. It was all so effective, and in fact, a little too effective. To be fair to Welles, he did announce four times during the program that everything was fictional, but he spaced out the first two announcements so far, one at the very beginning and one at the first station break at around the 40-minute mark, that listeners that tuned in late went nearly two-thirds of an hour without hearing that disclaimer. On top of that, Welles had broken with a convention that fictional programs like his would take a station break religiously at the 30-minute mark. But he opted to take it instead at the 40-minute mark to better fit his content. Unfortunately, however, taking no break at the 30-minute mark was a hallmark of actual breaking news, which only heightened the sense that the reports of aliens were in fact real. The extent of the public panic that ensued is somewhat debated. It would surely be an overstatement to say that the entire country was thrown into hysteria. But undeniably, some people were. The show's producer fielded a call from someone claiming to be a mayor of a Midwestern town where he said there were mobs out in the streets. during the broadcast, the studio became filled with police who wanted to break in and interrupt the show. A photographer even captured the perfect emblem of the day, a bespectacled 76-year-old man, a wary look on his face, and a shotgun in his hands. War of the Worlds was only fiction, but to those fooled by it, it certainly felt real, as if the very foundations of society had been torn down. That, I think, is exactly how David's advisors feel in Psalm 11. Although, to be fair to them, in their case, the crisis is absolutely real and not fictional. The crisis is namely this: wicked men in Israel hunted the righteous with violence and cunning, with no one to bring them to justice. Left unchecked, it seemed, as verse 3 says, that the foundations are being destroyed. That is, this normal civil order was disintegrating. Society was becoming unhinged. Nowhere in sight was the exercise of God's justice. Anarchy roamed in the streets. It must be something of the way that the residents of the Ukrainian city of Mariupol felt, hunkered down in their basements as marauding Russian troops ransacked and murdered their way through the city. All normal protections and security are gone. The glue that holds society together no longer adheres. The righteous seem like an endangered species. What are God's people to do in a time of great crisis like this? Psalm 11 is given to help answer that. Now, maybe, hopefully, you haven't lived through anything quite so desperate. But you have lived through other crises, haven't you? In fact, sometimes crises caused by injustice. And I think Psalm 11 still holds out help to you in that the counsel that's true there of the very worst kind of situation will also hold for lesser crises as well. And here are two truths in particular that the psalm gives to us. First, from verses 1 through 3, we need discernment when choosing our refuge. We need discernment when choosing our refuge. And the second, from verses 4 through 7, we need faith to behold the reigning, repaying king. We need faith to behold the reigning, repaying king. The second of those gives rise to our main idea today. Faith during crisis, the righteous Lord reigns and repays. So may God help us to cling to what we learn here when the foundations feel destabilized, when it seems the ground underfoot has given way. There is something stable we can turn to in those times. The king is on his throne. Today we're going to look at those two truths and finish by taking the Lord's Supper together. Here's the first truth, again, from verses 1 through 3, first part of the sermon. We need discernment when choosing our refuge. I want to set the scene here. After the superscription, David begins by responding to some advice he's been given. He says, "In the Lord I take refuge. How can you say to my soul, 'Flee like a bird to your mountain'? For behold, the wicked bend the bow. They fitted their arrow to the string to shoot in the dark at the upright in heart. If the foundations are destroyed, what can the righteous do?" The advice here in this section seems to come from people who are genuinely concerned about David's safety. Maybe they're official advisors to him while he was king. Maybe they're just simply friends before or during his kingship. At any rate, they're warning him in no uncertain terms, "David, Israel is not a safe place to be right now. The wicked are like these hunters ready to shoot the godly at any moment." And when we say ready, we mean that they have the arrow fitted to the string. We mean that they have the bow bent and poised. Watch out, David. Living in this place will decrease your life expectancy. Not only that, but we read that the wicked do their work in the dark, when night provides the best cover for violent men to lie in wait. So they're dangerous, but it's the worst kind of danger, the hidden kind, the covert kind, the kind you don't see coming until it's too late. No doubt, then, the advice is well meant. No doubt the advisors can think of freshly dug graves in Israel that they've seen. No doubt they don't want David's to be the next. There's a bit of debate about how far their quotation goes on. Some translators extend it to the end of verse 3, others only through verse 1. And I'm not sure that's especially needful for us to resolve, because on either option, David is not disputing the gravity of the situation. The facts are the facts. The wicked are every bit as dangerous as either David or his friends say. They really have destabilized Israelite society. And so when David pushes back here, he's not challenging the facts, but rather the conclusion that his friends have drawn from the facts. He's not denying that he needs refuge, he's disagreeing with them about where true refuge lies. Look at verse 1 again. In the Lord I take refuge, he says. How can you say to my soul, flee like a bird to your mountain? David's friends thought that true refuge was found in the mountains. The mountains will save you, David. Go hide out there. But notice how David is pushing back on that. In the Lord, he says, I take refuge. It's all a matter of where ultimate help comes from. Does it come from mountain hideouts? Does it come from horses and chariots? Does it come in these days from the sleekest home defense system? Or is the ultimate object of our trust to be in the Lord our God? David's friends seem to be dislocating God from his proper place. And they're thinking, God doesn't have a place in this calculus about safety. But for David, God is at the very center of the way that he sizes up the situation. Mountain hideouts without Yahweh's protection get you nothing. And that's why I say we need discernment when choosing our refuge. Pastorally, I feel like there are two mistakes to push back on here. Two mistakes as we apply this. The first, and the one David's friends were making, was misidentifying where ultimate refuge lies. They thought it was in heading for the hills. Today, while you and I may probably not often entertain physically relocating as the solution when hard times come, we can try to flee to other sources of help instead of God, other saviors, we might call them, in which we put our trust. Alcohol, drugs, sex, shopping, food, sports, friends, etc. I think the appeal so many times of trusting these things is because they're so tangible and often so immediate in their gratification. But the thing we've all found out is that once their happiness wears off, we're right back where we were, and in many cases, even worse off. And that's because we're asking of these things to do what only God Himself can, to be our true refuge and help in time of trouble. I wonder if you've learned yourself well enough to know which functional saviors you tend to turn to. Think back to your last crisis, when you thought to yourself, maybe not in these exact words, but I need to flee like a bird, right? Fill in the blank with what you said. I'll fly to blank for ultimate help and refuge and safety. What did you answer there? What did you turn to? It's worth noting that this is a test question with only one correct answer. And that's because there's only one Savior who can really save, the true and living God. So ultimate help lies with Him. But the second mistake I think we need to avoid is to think that trusting God is incompatible with using means to escape danger. Sometimes we trust Him as we make use of the means that He's given us to escape. So the person who encounters a mugger in a dark alleyway prays while he reaches for whatever weapon is closest at hand to defend himself. The battered wife trusts God while she packs a bag to leave and get out of harm's way. The godly public figure rests in God's protection while he still retains a detail of bodyguards. So using means is not incompatible with true faith when it comes to our safety, any less than it is for a whole host of other things in which we trust God and use the means he's provided. Now you believe as a Christian that God will meet your financial needs, don't you? And yet, if you have a job, you're still going to work tomorrow, aren't you? You believe that God will mature you and grow you in your faith, and yet you'll still read your Bible this week. You believe that God will save all of his chosen people, and yet you still share the gospel with the lost. And that's because you know that means matter. And the same thing is true here, which is why on some occasions in his life, David actually does flee to the mountains. He does that to get away from Saul on one occasion. And it's why Jesus once told his disciples, when they persecute you in one town, flee to the next. Matthew 10:23. That's not to say that we should always flee from danger. Sometimes we calculate that the risk is in fact worth it, like when soldiers defend their country or people stand up to bullies for the sake of those they're bullying. What we want to do is give you both of those options to keep open. It takes wisdom to know when to flee and when to fight, and that's probably best worked out with the help of some wise Christians that you trust. So if I can try to capture these last two points I've been making in two sentences, it would be this. Safety can be sought through means while still trusting God ultimately, but safety can't be appropriately sought while trusting other saviors instead of God. Challenging stuff, isn't it? We need discernment when choosing our refuge. But not only that, as we see in our second section, we need faith to behold the reigning, repaying King. And I say faith because David is absolutely apprehending these realities by faith and not by physical sight. Verse 3 has just described this situation in which the very foundations of society seem shaken. But now, beginning in verse 4, we see a foundation that's not going anywhere. Look at verses 4 through 7. The Lord is in his holy temple. The Lord's throne is in heaven. His eyes see, his eyelids test the children of man. The Lord tests the righteous, but his soul hates the wicked and the one who loves violence. Let him rain coals on the wicked. Fire and sulfur and a scorching wind shall be the portion of their cup. For the Lord is righteous. He loves righteous deeds. The upright shall behold his face. Here David sees the controlling reality in the universe. The king is on his throne. That's what verse 4 means when it says, the Lord is in his holy temple. The Lord's throne is in heaven. Now, if Psalm 11 was written while David was king, no doubt he had considered running as his friends advised. But what stabilizes him here is this vision of the great king who is in residence, not in flight. And David says it with emphasis, the Lord is in his holy temple. The Lord in heaven is his throne. More fixed than wickedness run amok, surely more fixed than society's crumbling foundations, is Yahweh enthroned. Here's the fixed point. Everything else can give way. Now, if we stopped our reading there in verse 4, we might ask whether this picture actually helps our faith very much. After all, if we remember that Solomon's temple wasn't yet built, and so both lines speak of God in his heavenly temple, we might ask how much good it does for him to tell us that he's way all the way up there in heaven, sitting down on a throne, while we're here on earth dealing with these urgent catastrophes. But that's why we need to keep reading and see what God is doing on behalf of his people from upon that throne. The rest of verse 4 shows him seeing, observing, testing the children of men, and that's merely a prelude to verses 5 through 7, which show him using that knowledge to act as repayer of each one's deeds. So Dale Ralph Davis is right when he says that this picture does not imply that Yahweh is removed, but that he rules. His throne is not a place of inactivity, but of supremacy. It does not suggest distance, but dominion. And from his throne, God will punish the wicked and reward the upright. Turns out you can do a lot from a throne. So verse 4 doesn't give us a God who is aloof, but one who is right where you want him to be. Mo Berg has the distinction of being, to my knowledge, the only person ever to play Major League Baseball and work as a spy for the U.S. government. It's an eventful life. In 1934, he was doing a bit of both of those things in Japan, taking along his glove and cleats for a series of exhibition games, and also his 16mm motion camera to take covert footage of the country. On one particular day, he skipped the team's game to travel to see the American ambassador's daughter in her Tokyo hospital, which happened to be one of the tallest buildings in the city. He wore a black kimono, carried a bouquet of flowers, and told the hospital staff in serviceable Japanese that he was a family friend. They waved him right through. But when the elevator got to the 7th floor, he didn't walk into Mrs. Burton's room. Instead, he went to the stairwell, and from there, to the roof. From that towering vantage point, he was able to take rare footage of Tokyo for American intelligence. Its industrial plants, its oil refineries, its railroad yards, the warships in the bay. Nearly a decade later, American fighter pilots would use Berg's films to prepare for a surprise air raid on Tokyo. But that day, Berg simply slipped his camera back under his kimono and quietly stole away. He never did visit the ambassador's daughter. And maybe there's something of a similarity in his story to the way we think about God's help and the forms in which it may come. We may think that up high is no place at all from which to help, that it seems desperately disconnected from our needs down low in the hospital rooms of life. But for Mo Berg, up high was the place from which he was strategically helpful, where he acted with his country's interest chiefly in mind. It's the same way with God up high on his heavenly throne, whose eyes see and eyelids test the children of man, so that he can help his beleaguered people by repaying the inhabitants of the earth. Now, as for that repaying, it's all written plainly in verses 5 through 7. On the one hand, when it comes to the wicked, in verses 5 through the first part of verse 7, we read that the Lord tests the righteous, but his soul hates the wicked and the one who loves violence. Let him rain coals on the wicked, fire and sulfur, and a scorching wind shall be the portion of their cup. For the Lord is righteous. He loves righteous deeds. That judgment language in verse 6 might sound familiar to you. It harkens back to what God did to the cities of Sodom and Gomorrah in Genesis 19, which becomes something of a test case in the rest of the Bible for God's ability to bring sudden, devastating final judgment. Listen to Jesus himself make this point from Luke 17. Jesus says, "Likewise, just as it was in the days of Lot, they were eating and drinking, buying and selling, planting and building. But on the day when Lot went out from Sodom, fire and sulfur rained from heaven and destroyed them all. So it will be on the day when the Son of Man is revealed." And that's the same reassurance David is holding on to here, that one day God will say enough to all the wickedness in this world and will devastate the wicked with irreversible judgment. Now they operate with a sense of safety, but that's exactly where their vulnerability lies, because hanging over their heads unseen is the dangling sword of divine justice, ready to cut off their power, their future, and their very lives. Or to use the imagery from our text, a bucket of burning coals lies overhead, ready to scorch them everlastingly. Friends, doesn't this change the way we see those enemies? When we stare only at them, they can seem so powerful and so intimidating. But when we get our eyes on our God, the wicked of this world get cut down to size. Imagine if you visited Moscow right now. Vladimir Putin's lavish trappings and military might would make you feel pretty small. It's just one American civilian. But when you see it David's way, the Psalm 11 way, that God is merely sizing up every tyrant and thug for their portion of burning coals, the wicked lose quite a bit of their luster. Seeing King Yahweh by faith cuts down to size all would-be rivals. And if that's true for the world's greatest evil figures, isn't it true for all the lesser ones as well? The person maybe who unfairly sabotaged you at work, the person who slandered you behind your back, the abuser in your past, the parent that mistreated you, even down to the person who recklessly cut you off in traffic this week, they'll all have to answer to the king who beckons brimstone. Doesn't that mean then that we can leave the injustices we've suffered with him to redress? And if he truly hates the wicked, isn't that hatred enough for the both of us? In fact, would it surprise you to learn that God is even more angered by the mistreatment you've experienced than even you are? That he's even more committed to justice against you, against those people who've hurt you than you are? After all, the explanation for the judgment in verse 6 is the words of verse 7. "For the Lord is righteous. He loves righteous deeds." Sounds to me then that the situation's in good hands already. Sounds like God doesn't even need my hands to get involved. Vengeance is his. He will repay. But speaking of that commitment to repay, it also works in a different direction in the end of verse 7. Notice how this psalm ends. I love this. The end of verse 7 says, "The upright shall behold his face." What a promise that is. Those whose hearts God has transformed by his grace will receive the thing they long for most, which is this unmediated communion with him in the life to come. We will behold his face, it says. This is the gift that not only ends pain, but adds supreme pleasure. Do you feel yourself, Christian, longing for this? Is seeing Jesus the great desire of your heart? Are you ready for him to return and make all things right? It is strange, isn't it? We have to admit where we're strange. It's strange that we Christians, along with David, can so deeply love one whom we've never laid eyes on? And yet this is part of what it means to be a Christian, to know and love one who is as yet unseen, and to find more and more that the hope in verse 7 is your greatest hope, to behold the Lord. In that way, we're something like the man William Dyke that Dale Ralph Davis says was blinded in his early life by an accident. But Dyke didn't allow his disability to stop him from earning high marks in school and in time becoming engaged to a lovely woman. Sometime before the wedding date, Dyke's case came to the attention of a skillful surgeon who suggested that there might be something that could be done for Dyke to recover his sight. So he put himself into the hands of the surgeon. The surgery was performed, and on the very day of the wedding, the bandages were removed. Hence it happened that he saw his bride for the first time when they met at the front of the church sanctuary. What a moment of joy that must have been. And yet in one sense, it was simply the proper fulfillment of all that had gone before. He had already held her hand, heard her voice, prized her love. Now he saw her face. But he loved her before he ever laid eyes on her. And that's our story too, isn't it? A deep love for Jesus, even though we have never seen his face. But verse 7 reminds us, we expect to. We expect to. And that's meant to keep us going through life's hardships with our eyes on that reward. The upright shall behold his face.